I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. This week, 2011 comes to an end. During the year NASA's 30-year shuttle program retired, jobs remained a primary holiday wish in a state where unemployment remains near 10%. Politicians and everyday Floridians are wondering, where will jobs come from? It was a year of travel for the Intersection team, which gathered interviews from Kennedy Space Center, the Everglades, the Morse Museum, and the historic house of writer Jack Kerouac. It's the most interesting Central Florida stories of 2011, ahead on Intersection. The shuttle program's retirement in July places NASA at a crossroads. Laid-off space industry workers number in the tens of thousands. 90.7's Intersection team traveled to Kennedy Space Center just before the final space shuttle mission to interview the man whose job it was to give the final go for launch, shuttle launch director Mike Leinbach. He discussed what the shuttle's retirement means for American space exploration.
Of course, it means there'll be a lengthy gap in the ability of America to launch American astronauts on American rockets to the space station or any other destination. Transitioning some of the launch services to commercial providers, I'm not opposed to that at all. I think that's a good plan. The problem with retiring the shuttle now is that we don't have that next generation of vehicles ready. They're not working. They're not launching. And therefore, there's a gap in America's ability to launch our astronauts. We will launch them to the space station on Russian Soyuz on their vehicle, and that's a very proven system, very reliable. But if they have a problem, then we can't get to the space station, and therefore the space station would be in jeopardy after a period of time. So I see it as a policy issue where you're shutting down a system before the next system is up and running. And if I were in charge, and I'm not, but if I were in charge, I would do it the other way. I wouldn't shut down the shuttle system until the next system was up and running so we could guarantee access to the space station.
So you're approaching the liftoff of Shuttle Atlantis, the 135th mission of the shuttle program. What's that going to mean for you and your team?
After the last flight of Discovery and the last flight of Endeavor, people were asking, well, what does that feel like? And it felt like another successful mission to me. The astronauts, we launched them, conducted a great mission, they landed safely. And so it was another in the 130-some missions that we pulled off. And this one will be different because there are no more. And so when we see Atlantis on the runway after mission complete, after wheel stop, that'll be the end of the program. And I'm not sure how people will react. There will still be the exhilaration and jubilation of mission complete for that particular mission. The astronauts will still get off, and they'll be happy, and there'll be handshakes, and they'll walk around the vehicle just as we always do and marvel in it out on the runway. But then when we leave the runway, we will know there will never be another one there. And I haven't even started thinking about that yet. I haven't thought about it yet.
Do you have any idea what you might miss?
The shuttle program has... It means so much to the people that work in it. And the thing I'm going to miss the most are the people that are affected dramatically by the decision to shut the program down. Literally thousands of dedicated workers who were put in 20, 30 years are being laid off. A lot of my friends are being laid off, gals I play golf with. They're all being laid off. And so, for me, it's more than just the retirement of the shuttle program. It's a breaking up of a family that has been together for so long. As I mentioned earlier, I get to know these people so well. I can tell by the tone of their voice if they're go or no go. It's the same thing in all systems and at all levels of this program. People have worked in this program and have dedicated their careers and their lives to it. And when it stops and people get laid off, it'll be like a family breaking up.
What's going to happen to you after the final wheel stop of Shuttle Atlantis?
Well, I don't know yet. I'm a civil servant, and so I'll be employed. I'm not quite sure what I'll be doing. We have other customers that will potentially want to use some of the facilities at the Kennedy Space Center, and I'll work on some of that. But I'll be honest with you, it won't be the same as launching the shuttle. It and working with this fabulous team. You know, the shuttle is an American icon. You know, anywhere in the world, if people pay attention to the news and they see the shuttle launch, they know that's America launching that shuttle. No one else does that, and now we won't either. And so, to a degree, we're losing a bit of our American identity by shutting the system down.
That was Shuttle Launch Director Mike Leinbach. Since we spoke, Leinbach has left NASA to join another aerospace company. The end of 2011 also means Governor Rick Scott is near the end of his first year in office. The governor campaigned on the promise he would create 700,000 jobs in 7 years. Scott says he's concerned about strings being attached to federal dollars and jobs programs. I asked him to explain that more.
I look forward to looking at it. You know, all the federal programs, there's always strings attached. But as we all know, those are our dollars. They go up there. They come back with strings. But I look forward to seeing what they're going to come back with and see if it makes sense for Florida. You know, if the president wanted right now to create jobs, what he would do is he would send the three free trade agreements to Congress and get those ratified for Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. Those would generate thousands of private sector jobs in Florida and around the country. So that's what I'd like him to do right now.
What's an acceptable string to be attached to federal money, and what's not an acceptable string to be attached to federal money?
Well, I think what you have to look at on all the federal money, we always have to remember that's our money that we send to them. And historically, Florida has been so-called a donor state. We send way more money to the federal government than they send back. But does it fit within what we're trying to accomplish in the state? Or is it going to create a program that ultimately is going to require taxes to go up? So if it fits within with what we want to accomplish for Floridians, then we'll be interested in looking at it. If all it's going to do is create a program that we never had an interest in creating in Florida, and then they're going to have the expectation that we continue it after they stop the funding, then we won't be doing those type of programs.
Do you think that because Florida has that reputation of being a donor state, that if you reject this money, does Florida lose something then? Or do you fulfill that prophecy then if you reject it of making Florida stay in that donor state status?
Well, I'm going to be focused on doing what's right for Floridians and making sure that the money that we take is money that fits within our needs. As you know, for example, we need to expand our ports. It's a big opportunity for Florida. We should be a significant shipping capital for the world with the expansion of the Panama Canal. Our ports need dollars for dredge and things like that. We need to work on our cargo rail infrastructure. So there's a lot of great programs that they could help us with, and I hope with the support of Chairman Micah that those are the types of things that will happen.
Floridians on the Space Coast in the middle of their own economic downturn right now with the retirement of the shuttle program. Of course, recently a long-range vision for a brand-new rocket was announced. But I wonder, what are you planning to do right now to help retain any of the highly skilled workforce that is out of work right now on the Space Coast?
Well, I think the Space Coast is a significant opportunity for Florida. We have such unbelievable talent there. And so what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of new companies started. There's a lot of companies interested in moving there because of all that talent. I did a trade mission, as you know, in June up to Canada, and a lot of companies, especially in Toronto that I sat down with, are very interested in expanding in the Space Coast area because of the talent pool we have there. We're also going to work on making sure that we continue to do private launches there, and so I think there's a significant opportunity going forward.
Who's better positioned, though, to help the Space Coast right now? Because for so long they've been reliant on the federal government. Is the state in a better position to help workers right now who are out of a job?
Well, I think it takes, first off, the local community's got to figure out exactly what they need. And look, government doesn't create jobs. Government creates an environment where private companies create jobs.
But if they have a big rockets program, if they have a big rocket program that's federally funded, Governor, isn't that the federal government creating jobs?
That's federal government spending money, and it creates jobs. But the long term, the real opportunity there is with the private sector.
And so, Governor, is there a priority for the Space Coast this session or anything in the works?
We're working on a lot of things around talking to companies that have an interest in coming to the Space Coast, making sure that this, whether it's regulations or whether it's taxes or whether it's fees, that people want to open their businesses around the Space Coast. I'm also doing a trade mission down to Brazil in October. There's a lot of aviation that comes out of Brazil. As you know, Embraer opened up a plant there this year. to build two of their jets, and I'm hoping that they're going to expand their operations in the Space Coast area.
That was Governor Rick Scott. You're listening to Intersection's Best of 2011 program on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. Tell us what your favorite Intersection programs are from 2011 on Facebook and Twitter, or visit us at WMFE.org/intersection. Coming up next on Intersection's Best of 2011, a jump from the edge of space. One of our coolest interviews of the year was with Joe Kittinger. In 1960, Kittinger flew a balloon as part of an Air Force program to the edge of space, said a prayer, and jumped. At his fastest, he fell more than 600 miles an hour. Today, he still holds the record for the highest parachute jump. Kittinger's feat was aimed at developing a high-altitude escape system for astronauts. He described his big jump on Intersection.
The program was called Excelsior. And as I pointed out, this was my third jump. It was done from New Mexico. We took off about 6 o'clock in the morning. It took an hour and a half to get up to altitude. And at about 40,000 feet, I discovered that my pressure suit glove on my right hand was not working. And I was faced with a dilemma. If I told the people on the ground, I knew they would make me abort the flight. So I opted not to tell them. I went ahead and flew with my pressure suit glove not working.
And what does that mean? What happens when that's not working?
Well, when it's not working, the lack of pressure, you're in a vacuum, and your hand swells up to twice its normal size, and it's rather painful, and you can't use it. And it's all of that is prevented if you have pressurization. But no pressurization, I could not use my right hand. But I took a calculated risk to go ahead and do it without telling the people on the ground. And everything we designed we could use either hand, right or left hand. So I was able to do the jump without use of my right hand.
Why not tell them and try to make another go at it?
Well, because it was a very low-budget program, and I wasn't certain we could get the money to do it if we aborted that flight. And I felt it was very important they would get the information, so I opted not to tell them on the ground, because they would have made me abort the flight if I would have told them.
So
that was a conscious decision on my part not to tell them. So I get to 102,800 feet, and I drift for 11 minutes while the balloon gets over exactly the right spot. And then I said a prayer and hit the button to start the cameras running and jumped.
Now, what were you thinking when you're up there floating around in this upper level of the atmosphere?
Well, first of all, it's very beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. You can see for 500 miles. You can up overhead, it's absolutely black, and you can see the world from a very high angle. But it's very hostile. Space is hostile to man, and without the elaborate protection against the vacuum of space, you die very quickly. It's 100 degrees below zero, which is very cold. So it's beautiful, but it's hostile. And, of course, I was there as a test pilot. I was there to gather information that we needed for the program. So I was extremely busy. I was flying the balloon and communicating with the ground, and I was very busy. And when it came time to go, I didn't hesitate at all. I had been trained to do it. I was a test pilot, and I was there to make the jump. And I had confidence in myself and confidence in my equipment and confidence in my team. So when it came time to go, I was ready to go.
When you made that jump, what did you experience?
Well, first of all, I fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds. I was extremely busy. I was describing how my parachute was working. I was manipulating my body so that I could go different directions. I was checking out the pressure suit, my mobility. I was there as a test pilot. I was there to gather information that we needed, that we were there for. So I was extremely busy and falling very, very rapidly. I reached about 614 miles an hour and then at about 90,000 feet. And from then on, constantly slowed down because the density was increasing as I fell. And the parachute opened at about 14,000 feet. And from then, once the main parachute opened, then the rest of the jump was rather anticlimactic.
Wow, I don't know if there could be really such a thing as that being anticlimactic, but I'll take your word for it. How fast did those 4 minutes go by when you were in that free fall?
It went by extremely fast. I had an altimeter and a stopwatch on my left wrist. And just before I jumped, I started the stopwatch going. And we had computed it would take 4 minutes and 37 seconds. It actually took 4 minutes and 36 seconds. So we were extremely close on what we had planned for the free fall. But I was very busy during that time.
That was Joe Kittinger, who holds the record for the highest parachute jump. Besides the Kennedy Space Center, the intersection team also traveled to the Charles Hosmer Morse Museum of American Art in Winter Park for a tour of a new wing displaying recently restored works by Lewis Comfort Tiffany. In fact, it's where I started thinking about one of our most common materials in a whole new light. Look at a piece of glass. Maybe you're drinking out of one right now. Look at it closely. It's probably smooth, clear, or maybe a little color. Well, that's all fine and well if you want to just drink out of it or look through a window. But when Lewis Comfort Tiffany created masterpieces of glass, he wanted it rough and raw.
He wanted imperfections. He wanted ripples. He wanted many colors in one piece of glass. He liked bubbles. Anything that could happen in a piece of glass, he loved. And he cultivated all of those.
That's Larry.
Technically speaking, it's Dr. Lawrence Ruggiero.
Okay, Dr. Lawrence Ruggiero. Well, when you're the director of the Charles Hosmer Morse Museum of American Art in Winter Park, I guess you expect to be talking to a doctor of some sort. The Morse Museum already housed one of the most comprehensive collections of work by Lewis Comfort Tiffany. Now, more than 80 years after Tiffany's death, they just opened a new wing to house even more. Tiffany was famous for designing rooms and lamps and jewelry and windows for staid Victorians and wealthy industrial barons in the early 20th century. Larry Ruggiero says he was a unique interior designer.
We think today of interior designers as, well, there's one down the block, but this was a different time. And he was really a maker of total interior environments.
So, for Tiffany, it was windows, it was fabulous homes, and it was churches and many other things.
And then he began to supplying the goods and then making the goods, and he developed a special kind of glass called opalescent glass or American glass. And that led to the windows. And the windows are these symphonic creations of light and color. From the windows, he proceeded to design for a chapel interior, and the entire interior. He had an ecclesiastical... Yeah, you were begging to say something.
Well, just that you've got to talk about the lamps. I mean, electricity, it was a new thing.
And who doesn't like art that lights up?
Right, nobody, especially with those rich greens and blues and the ripples and the swirls that you find in that glass. And you think, would my place look great if I installed that new LED light in that? Well, but then you got to think, well, what about the bulb?
They're very relatively weak bulbs. We look at them today and we'd say, oh my goodness, that's not going to light anything. But when they were introduced, the light was considered so harsh, he produced glass pendants to put between you and the lamp so you wouldn't have to directly face that harsh artificial light.
But truly, nothing that shines through Tiffany glass could be called harsh, especially the latest pieces on display at the Morse Museum, which is right next to the railroad tracks in Winter Park. Most of these works have been in the collection for years, but were never able to be displayed. That's because many of them were damaged from a fire in 1957 that destroyed Tiffany's home on Long Island called Laurelton Hall. Larry Ruggiero says Laurelton Hall was huge.
Hundreds of acres.
And many rooms?
Hundreds of rooms.
That Tiffany used to create and display deeply personal works. Beautiful glass-paneled windows showing brightly colored, almost three-dimensional wisteria bushes that are now displayed in a room emulating Tiffany's own dining room. I had to ask Larry, since Tiffany was working so hard to emulate nature, which one did he like better? The idea of the natural bushes or the work actually made by Tiffany?
His. I like his because his are made by a human being. And Tiffany, I think, saw himself in almost a struggle with nature. He knew, like all of us, that there was ultimately a tragic end to life. But that in rebelling against that, he was going to be as good a creator as an immortal could have been.
Of course, you can see pictures of those wisteria windows at our webpage, wmfe.org/intersection, plus images of the amazing outdoor-covered daffodil terrace, which marked one of the entrances to Laurelton Hall. The Morse Museum created a new enclosure to house
the actual terrace that Tiffany had at Laurelton Hall in which he used and stepped out on.
And it's framed by white marble columns that are capped with bouquets of glass yellow daffodils with green stems. They support a series of recessed bays in the ceiling with arabesque stencils and designs. And at the center of the terrace is a skylight that bathes the whole enclosure in natural light.
So we've even enclosed the courtyard and planted around to try to make a really nice background so that when you step on this terrace, you have some sense of what it must have been like to step onto this wonderful place of marble and glass.
It has become a focal point for the new exhibit and is something the Morse Museum's founders, Hugh and Jeanette McCain, would be proud of. Hugh McCain studied with Tiffany at Laurelton Hall and went there after the fire in 1957 to salvage pieces of the great estate. Now, after decades of working to get the more than 250 items salvaged from Laurelton Hall on display, the Morse Museum expansion brings to life the grandeur of Lewis Comfort Tiffany in a new and vibrant way and brings a sense of satisfaction to these most recent steps along Tiffany's quest for beauty. The Intersection team also went on the road to the historic Orlando house of writer Jack Kerouac. Kerouac, best known for his classic book On the Road, lived right in College Park. Bob Keeling, we're in kind of the immediate room. You've just come in through the front door. What do you see?
Well, this it's filled with books appropriately, and it has a kind of a really nice, updated, but yet kind of a hip 1950s look that you might imagine from that time period. And it's been home to dozens of aspiring writers since this program started in 1999. And it's a pleasure to have you here.
And Billy Collins, this is your first visit to the Kerouac House. What are your impressions?
Well, it's small. It's a rather modest-looking house. I mean, if you compare it to, I don't know, Robertson Jeffers' house in Carmel overlooking the Pacific, or even Hemingway's house in Key West, rather elaborate with one of the first swimming pools in North America. It's a very modest, unprepossessing house, and but it says so much, I think, the size of it, the modest size of it, and the location of it says so much about Kerouac, who, you know, was on the road reaching for what he called the pearl, you know, always on the search. If you can go faster and faster, you'll find something out there. And to land here, it's a very kind of paradoxical, I wouldn't say the ending of his life, but the latter part of his life to be enclosed in this modest house in Orlando.
Bob Keeling, lead us through and describe where we're going as you can take us.
Right, we're actually going to go to the back porch part of this house. Believe it or not, even though this place is small, the front of the house would be like living in the Taj Mahal compared to where we're going in the back. And this doorway that we're entering was the actual dividing line between the two dwellings.
So it was originally a split dwelling. It's now been combined into one.
And when I first came back here 15 years ago, there were a pair of antique dealers living here. And I think they were having a tough time staying in retirement because they had bric-a-brac all over the place. I didn't even know this bedroom over here existed. So as I come in this tiny little door here, which is, what, maybe 6 feet tall, it's open, and there are squirrels running in and out.
And Billy Collins is taller than the door.
Well, you'd have to duck to walk in this back door, yeah. Even if you were a squirrel, you might have to duck.
So the squirrels are running around in here, and what do you find?
So the squirrels are coming running around, and this nice lady who's sitting on this divan-type convertible sofa bed invites me to sit down. So I kind of take a seat here, and as I'm talking to her about Kerouac and having lived here, I notice something crawling on my shoulder, and it's a roach, so I kind of brush it off my shoulder as I'm talking to her. I mean, this is the kind of the existence that these people were living in. This place was covered with this austere brown paneling that made it look more like a cave than an actual apartment.
And now it's kind of nice pastel colors.
It is. I mean, it's gotten at least a nice little facelift, but I dare say it's still rather beat back here. But in on a more serious note, it is compelling. It is moving to think that while Kerouac finally receives the notoriety, the respect as a writer that he's been dying to have, he's still living in this meager, really poverty-ridden, hand-to-mouth existence, but he keeps working at it, you know. But he finally saw some success. He's finally on the New York Times bestseller list while he's living here.
Now, what room did he actually write in while he was here?
Well, he wrote in this 10x10 bedroom back here. So if you like, let's head on back.
So this is a really small room. I mean, this is about the size of maybe a college dorm room single, if you're lucky.
I think this is the room where, even though I've just been here, this is my first visit, this is the room where I got the kind of feeling for Kerouac. On the wall, there's kind of three photographs of him sitting there typing with a flannel shirt. And apparently that was done in this room. And it is a tiny room, and it's really quite exciting to think that Dharma Bums, which is basically about hiking in the Sierra Mountains in California and being running around with Gary Snyder, all took place in this, I would say, rather claustrophobic environment.
A freedom of the mind not confined by your physical surroundings.
Absolutely, and somebody was mentioning last night that at Robertson Jeffers' house that overlooks the Pacific, his writing desk faced a wall. You know, he didn't want to look at the Pacific. It was, the view is of your imagination, and in Kerouac's case, memory. And memories can take place in a closet.
That's Kerouac researcher Bob Keeling and writer and former poet laureate Billy Collins. For Intersection, 2011 was full of interviews with writers, actors, and musicians. The bluegrass band Ramblin' Rose traveled from Tuningville outside of Lakeland to perform, and Ramblin' Rose takes us out on this week's show. Conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. You can visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can listen for your favorite Intersection shows and also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening in 2011.